This is The Rotunda, your podcast about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. I'm Tramell Gomes.
The aircraft that were destroyed in this attack, some of them were probably the ones used in that assault. And so I do think it achieves an important strategic measure. It will not degrade his entire capability to do some of this, especially as the Russians continue to support him.
Senator Marco Rubio applauds President Trump's attack on Syria.
I'm worried about the consumer of healthcare and that the impact that a deregulated environment could have on the cost, quality, and access for the patient.
Hospitals get caught in the conservative movement to deregulate.
You know, people come in with the best of intentions using technology, and I'm a big technology buff, but sometimes it seems like a power grab from government.
City of Miami Commissioner Francis Suarez calls on the Senate to give the green light on repealing the red light camera law.
I think her stance is dead wrong, both from a policy perspective, I'm a believer in the death penalty, but also from a rule of law perspective.
Florida House candidate Bernie Jacques weighs in on the issues as he attempts to make his way into the legislature.
Because I want to protect the opportunities that I had growing up in this great state.
All that and more coming up on episode 101 of The Rotunda. Those are the sounds from an anti-war protest in Jacksonville growing violent as police clash with protesters and pro-Donald Trump supporters over U.S. missile strikes in Syria. Senator Marco Rubio hailed President Trump's decision to launch airstrikes against a Syrian airbase, saying the president has an obligation to act. Here is Rubio on ABC News discussing the strike's impact to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
I believe it degrades his ability. That is an important airfield. Has strong strategic value. The aircraft that were destroyed in this attack, some of them were probably the ones used in that assault. And so I do think it achieves an important strategic measure. It will not degrade his entire capability to do some of this, especially as the Russians continue to support him. But he is certainly not just less capable, but I believe less willing this morning to do that sort of activity because his cost-benefit analysis just changed dramatically.
Meanwhile, Senator Bill Nelson says the United States should go further and figure out a way to oust the Syrian president. And until then,
there's got to be a political settlement in Syria. And what the Russians are interested in, they want to keep their base there on the Mediterranean. And that can all be worked out in a political settlement.
Miami Republican representatives Carlos Curbelo and Ileana Ross-Leighton both applauded the strikes. Democrat Ted Deutch called on President Trump to rethink his harmful ban on Syrian refugees. Coming up later in the program, we talk with a former state prosecutor hoping to make his way into the Florida House. Bernie Jacques weighs in on the issues. For instance, was State Attorney Aramis Ayala right in her decision to not pursue the death penalty for cases under her tenure?
I think her stance is dead wrong, both from a policy perspective, I'm a believer in the death penalty, but also from a rule of law perspective.
The city of Miami continues its fight to get rid of red light cameras. Miami City Commissioner Francis Suarez brings his case to the Capitol.
I passed a resolution unanimously in the last commission meeting or in a few commission meetings ago for this legislative session that is supporting the repeal statewide of cameras.
This is The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes. Here on the fourth floor rotunda, City of Miami Commissioner Francis Suarez is making the rounds on a mission to end some of the dysfunction and traffic problems in his city.
Yeah, so it's day days, what they call day days, and I'm not only commissioner, but I'm also president of the Miami-Dade League of Cities. So we have 34 municipalities in Dade County, and I'm here on their behalf as well, pushing a variety of different, very important pieces of legislation that are critical to the functionality or dysfunctionality of our city and county. And so,
any dysfunction in Miami? What's going on?
Well, if you talk to residents, I think they'll tell you that traffic and transit and congestion is a major dysfunction. I mean, we are sort of a product of our own success, you know, a victim of our own success, if you will. You know, we've got 2.7 million people, and the city's growing tremendously. The city of Miami, as one of the largest cities in Dade County, or the largest city in Dade County, has 30% growth the last 3 years alone. Yeah. So we're growing tremendously, but With that growth, we're seeing obviously a tremendous amount of increase in traffic and congestion. And so one of the things that we're up here for is supporting and talking about a bill that Anitere Flores at the Senate and Nick Duran in the House sponsored, which transformed itself into a ruling from the Florida Department of Transportation. What that ruling said is that Metrorail, which is our main transportation system, is a federally funded project, and any expansion of Metrorail, like the SMART plan, which is a strategic Miami area rapid transit plan, would be considered a federally funded project like Metrorail. What that means is that for non-federally funded projects, there's a 12.5% cap on what the state can contribute. Mm-hmm. Because it's now considered a federally funded project or an expansion of a federally funded project, that limitation no longer exists.
Yeah.
So they can go up to as much as 25%. And that's a tremendous amount of dollars for Dade County. That could mean as much as $800 to $1.2 billion of funding for our mass transit plan, which is critically needed. 88% of people in Dade County use cars to get to and from work. And
so how will this eliminate that traffic congestion of my time visiting Miami and sitting on the highway and all that traffic? So how will this help?
So the simplest way to explain it is that we have a pretty rudimentary system right now. It doesn't go far enough. It's not connected enough. And like any transit system, what you're doing is you're kind of creating a spider web, where you're trying to get as many parts of the county connected and make it easy for people to get to a transit hub, whether it be by Uber, whether it be by bicycle, whether it be by walking. Mm-hmm. The closer you have transit options, the more likely people are to take it. And specifically, if it's faster, if it's more efficient, and if it's less expensive.
So another transportation-related issues that's going on, red light cameras. I thought the state had rid of red light cameras, but it's not. What's going on?
So I kind of inherited that issue in the city of Miami. We have a program that is extremely punitive and extremely comprehensive. We have more red light cameras in the city than the city of New York. And so we have the most in the state of Florida. And what it's become is sort of an involuntary tax on our elderly. It's become an involuntary tax on our poor. And there's a lot of people in our city. We have a heavy elderly population. People that are living on fixed income, Social Security, $700, $800, $1,000 a month. They're trying to get by. And if they get a traffic ticket for some technical infraction, it's 20% of their monthly income that they have to pay. And what we're seeing is based on Senator Ortiz's request for a statewide study, is that unfortunately the justification for red light cameras, which was reduction of accidents, has actually been exactly the opposite. We've seen an increase in accidents, an increase in fatal accidents, which is very worrisome. And it's something that is incredibly unpopular. And it's just not, people come in with the best of intentions using technology, and I'm a big technology buff, but sometimes it seems like a power grab from government.
So the city of Tallahassee has managed to repeal and get rid of red light cameras. How come it hasn't been the same in Miami?
Well, it's definitely been, it hasn't been for lack of effort on my part. The state changed the law a couple years ago to force cities to become the appellate body, if you will. And when that happened, I brought a motion to the city commission based on the fact that I thought that was an event to cancel the contract, because the contract said if there's any change of state law which increases the obligation to the cities, you can cancel the contract. Unfortunately, it was a 3-2 vote. We have 5 members on our commission, and I failed to have them completely shut off. So what I've been doing is supporting legislative efforts. Like I passed a resolution unanimously in the last commission meeting, or in a few commission meetings ago, for this legislative session, that is supporting the repeal statewide of cameras. And if that doesn't work, we'll come back and try to continue to get them out as much as we possibly can.
This is The Rotunda. I'm Tramel Gomes, chatting with Miami City Commissioner Francis Suarez.
So how far will you take this effort in looking out for the city? I hear you might be running for office.
Yes, I'm actually running for mayor of Miami this November. We're in April. I'm the only candidate that's filed, the only major candidate. So I feel very blessed that our campaign has so far been that successful. Every single day, I always tell people, I pray for the best, I prepare for the worst, but I feel very blessed. We've been fundraising at a very high level. We've raised about a little more than $2 million for our race. So I think it's made it difficult, if somebody's really looking at it from a reasonable perspective, to get in at this point, because it's pretty late in the game.
Miami politics. From what I see, you guys get down and dirty and scrappy. Is there a lot of that? Yeah. Is it smooth sailing? What are you expecting?
Well, I mean, I think we live in an urban city, and certainly traditionally urban politics have been, you know, down and dirty, and you know, there's certainly a part of that that is, you know, you have to put in your hard work, you got to press the flesh, you have to talk to people, you have to touch people. In Miami, the voters are like, you know, when somebody goes to buy a car, you know, they want to kick the tires. Mm-hmm. They want to know that the person who they're dealing with is authentic, is someone who really cares. They don't want, you know, paper tiger. And so there's certainly a bunch of work that goes into it. What I feel blessed about, and it's very unusual, is to get to April without an opposition, you know, and that is something I hope speaks to the work that I've done, trying to be accessible, trying to be transparent, you know, working hard to, you know, for issues that people care about.
Yeah.
And hopefully that's what's translated in a lack of opposition.
What are you looking forward to if you are successful as mayor? What's your issue that you'll make sure that gets done, or thing that you want to see change immediately?
Well, from a vision perspective, obviously transportation is a big one, and we've talked about how to complete the smart plan. Affordable housing is another big one. We're a city that has the highest rental market as a percentage of income in the nation. Mm-hmm. So that's something that we have to continue to do, you know, working with the private sector to try to create more affordable housing like we've done in the city. And lastly, you know, I think, you know, we have to be a tech capital. We have to be a tech hub. You know, our generation is growing up with technology, and it's really impacting all generations. I have a 3-year-old son who knows how to use my iPhone, and I go to senior centers, and I got seniors that are taking selfies with me.
Yeah.
So, you know, the technology revolution is here, and to be an effective mayor, I think, is to make sure that the economy of your city works for everyone. And so for me, on the income side, I want to attract these companies, and then, of course, make sure that educationally, our kids can compete in that environment.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking awesome. This time to speak with me. I really appreciate
Thanks
it.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate you being on your podcast.
Thanks to City of Miami Commissioner Francis Suarez. So there's a lot going on in Tallahassee. It's beyond the halfway point, and there's a tug of war in the legislature over a regulatory process called Certificate of Need, or CON. Florida is among more than 30 states with CON regulations. So here's what it's all about. In a nutshell, facilities like hospitals or nursing homes must show there is a need in a community before adding another facility. But in the ongoing conservative wave to deregulate, the CON is on the chopping block.
Eliminating Certificate of Need is not a good thing for Florida.
John Corris is the president and CEO of Jupiter Medical Center, a 327-bed hospital in South Florida.
I'm a believer in appropriate regulation. I don't believe that we should be heavily regulated. But at the same time, I do believe that regulation, if designed in a thoughtful way, in a balanced way, regulation can be helpful. It can protect public interest, and it can keep sort of the balance of things in place.
But some argue the balance is off, that competition is missing. The James Madison Institute is pushing for the elimination of Certificate of Need. Their vice president of policy, Sal Nuzzo.
Now, in 1986, Ronald Reagan issued via the Federal Trade Commission an exhaustive study of the impact of CON laws. The report found that while they were intended to reduce costs, improve quality, and increase access to care, they in fact did the exact opposite. Fast forward, if you don't like Ronald Reagan, fast forward 30 years to President Barack Obama, who issued via the Federal Trade Commission and signed on by the Department of Justice a statement articulating that while intended to reduce costs, improve quality and access to care, CON laws in reality did the exact opposite. So regardless of whether your political persuasions lead you to revere the Gipper or no drama Obama, I implore you to take the first step in bringing real market forces to bear in the healthcare arena.
House Bill 7 calls for the repeal of certificates of need for hospitals. Nursing homes and hospice centers successfully fought to keep the CON process in place, but hospitals like Jupiter Medical are left to fight against a long priority of House Republican leaders and Governor Rick Scott, a former healthcare executive.
I'm worried about the consumer of healthcare and that the impact that a deregulated environment could have on the cost, quality, and access for the patient.
We'll talk more with John Corris to hear his concerns and his uphill battle to change the minds of the governor and House Republicans. The House Health and Human Services Committee already voted 12-5 to approve repealing Certificate of Need. Bill sponsor Alex Miller of Sarasota said the regulations on new facilities restrict competition and do not control costs.
When we think about what the legislator is trying to do, they'll tell you, because they've told me, well, we want to lower cost. And in a competitive environment, competition drives costs down. Well, it does in a pure free market environment. But healthcare, in my opinion, doesn't operate in a pure free market environment. To underscore that, when a patient comes through an emergency room, we're required by law to take care of every patient, regardless of their ability to pay. So if they come in with sniffles and a sore throat and want to be seen by an emergency room physician, we have to treat that, okay? By law, we have to see that patient. When they should be somewhere else, they should be in an urgent care center, they should be in a physician office, they shouldn't be in the emergency room. Very expensive. They get treated, they get seen, and then they're told, then they tell us they can't afford to pay, so they leave. What free market business do you know of that operates like that?
So, Mr. Corris, with the argument that they are just too much regulation, where do you see they are coming from? Or what do you think is going on as you argue that there needs to be some regulation in the sense of keeping the certificate of need intact?
For some of our legislators, I think this is more about ideology and politics than it is about doing the right thing for the Floridian. You know, what I've asked legislators to think about is what problem exists today that deregulation will solve? What's not working today that will be fixed by deregulating and eliminating certificate of need? And I would tell you and argue that we have wonderful facilities, wonderful physicians caring for the communities across Florida today. I think our state agency, ACA, does an excellent job at managing and regulating the healthcare environment. And so I'm not sure there's something that's necessarily broken in the system that would be fixed by deregulation. Now, if we want to talk about how we improve quality, how we improve clinical outcomes, how we improve patient safety, there's a plethora of things that we could do as a state to get after that activity and those opportunities. But deregulating isn't one of them. Deregulating isn't. Why do I say that? Because if you look at the research, if you look at the body of research in its totality, it's inconclusive around deregulated states improving quality or clinical outcomes or patient satisfaction or patient safety. The research is all over the board. There is a voluminous amount of research that supports the need for regulation, and there's an equal amount of data that supports the fact that maybe having an unregulated environment can improve service and quality and clinical outcomes.
So the CON process is sort of like the gatekeeper. It regulates who gets to come into the market. So from your standpoint in trying to find a reasoning behind this push, who is trying to enter the field that you're in right now? And is that what you think may be the issue here? That there may be some people who want to participate and they're being blocked by the certificate of need process?
Two quick comments. First, not only, by the way, does CON act as the gatekeeper, but it also allows the Floridian to have a voice in the process, because part of the CON process allows for the public to weigh in on whether or not they support or want a hospital in their community, which I think is very important. You take CON away, you take the voice of the Floridian away in this particular case, right? As far as who wants to come in, there's nobody that I know of that wants to come in tomorrow into my community and build another hospital. I don't know of any one individual or any one individual organization. But Florida, being the, you know, the third largest state in the union with a disproportionate share of Medicare patients, there will be more specialty hospitals. This is my thesis. There'll be more specialty hospitals and boutique facilities than we have today in the state. And that's not necessarily a good thing, because Jupiter Medical Center sits in Jupiter. We take care of a region from Stewart down to West Palm Beach. We do everything. We have an emergency room. We have obstetrics. We have a free clinic. We do a variety of things. New hospital comes in and decides, you know what, I'm not going to do all those things. I'm just going to do cardiology and oncology and orthopedics, the three service lines that make the most money in healthcare. I'll let that other hospital take care of everything else. I'll just take the cream off the top. What our hospital will be forced to do, and we're no different than any other hospital around the state, we'll be forced to do different things, meaning we might not be able to continue to provide obstetrics care in the community. We might not be able to continue to support a free clinic. We might not be able to continue to provide diabetes education, because all of those things either make no money or lose money, but we do them because we're a not-for-profit and we're supporting the community. It's our mission. So that's sort of what's at stake here. So the services that folks in my community have come to rely on, they run the risk of being eliminated or significantly changed. I'm not sure that's a good thing.
So I see this as a tough battle for you, as the bill is getting support of Governor Rick Scott and House leadership. What do you say to them, particularly the governor, with his healthcare background? Why isn't your message resonating?
Here's what I would say to them. First of all, I have a tremendous amount of respect for our governor, and I really have a lot of respect for our legislators. I think they're good people. I think they do good work. I think they're under a tremendous amount of pressure. However, in this particular case, I think they're misguided. And here's what I would tell them, and here's what I would expect, because Rick, I don't know him well. I do know him. But you know what? He was an effective leader. He ran a large organization relatively successfully. And I would tell him to apply the same principles he would apply in his own business. If there is a problem or a perceived problem, and we can define clearly, objectively, what that problem is, I would ask him to define the problem statement and then bring a group of people together to solve it. Meaning, a bipartisan group of individuals, of people like myself, of a few patients, of some legislators, of some staff, and sit down and roll up their sleeves collectively and in partnership with each other and identify the issues that are plaguing the state from a healthcare perspective and figure out the solutions. Figure out the solutions in a thoughtful, meaningful, genuine way. You know why? Because that's leadership. When people are asked to do that by their leaders, and in this case, Governor Scott being our leader because he's our governor, when people ask others to do that, that shows real leadership. And in my opinion, one guy, he's got an opportunity to be a real leader and to ask the legislature, Democrats, Republicans, administrators, doctors, patients, staff, to sit down together whether it's a blue ribbon panel, however it works up in government, and to really sit down together in a work group and spend a year identifying and understanding the problems and then building solutions together in partnership and in collaboration with each other. And for those who might think that this is naive, shame on them. because it's not naive. It's thoughtful, it's genuine, it's transparent, and it shows real leadership. That's what I would ask the governor to do.
That's John Corris, president and CEO of Jupiter Medical Center. The Senate has balked in the past years at repealing the certificate of need process and has not taken up a repeal bill, Senate Bill 676, this session. This is The Rotunda, your podcast about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. I'm Tramell Gomes. Visit rotundapodcast.com. Follow us on social media at Rotunda Podcast. And people are always shocked to learn that they can personally contribute to this program. Yes, you can send in your generous contribution of any amount by visiting rotundapodcast.com. And as always, thanks for your support. So here we are. Let's get back to the session tradition of hanging out downtown at one of the many watering holes to unwind and chat with the deal makers in the legislative process. This is where I got the chance to get to know a little more about Bernie Jacques, a 2018 candidate for Pinellas County's House District 66, a seat that's currently held by term-limited Republican Larry Ahern of Seminole.
I'm running for office simply because I'm passionate about serving others and because I want to protect the opportunity that I had growing up in this great state. Professionally, I'm an attorney, currently working in civil litigation. Now, prior to that, I served the people of the state of Florida as an assistant state attorney and the state prosecutor at the state attorney's office over in Pinellas County, where it was a great experience working with law enforcement officers, advocating for victims, and basically keeping our community safe.
So why do you want to run for office? Why do you want to get into this mess? Like, you know, this process in Tallahassee where many of the business, it's not really happening there at the Capitol. It's happening in bars like where we're sitting right here. So you're tipping into the process a little early. So why do you really want to be in the legislature?
Sure. And as I mentioned before, you know, my passion for serving others and protecting opportunities I had growing up. And basically what I mean by that is I'm a first generation American. Came here with my family when I was 7 years old from Haiti. And the opportunities that we had in this state was truly tremendous. And we're able to achieve the American dream, not because we're handed anything, not because we expect anything for free, but because there are opportunities there. And my parents always told me and my brothers that if you work hard, focus on your education, and you can add value, you will advance in this country. And so, and I've seen it in my own experience. You know, my parents were able to be homeowners within 6 years from the time they came to this country. My dad went on to earn a bachelor's degree, which he did mostly by taking night classes because he would work full time during the day. And I was able to go to college, graduate law school, serve as a state prosecutor. All within a short period, you know, and so I mean, it's a testament to our country and to our state, and in a sense, I have a debt to repay, and I find public service that outlet in order for me to make sure we preserve those opportunities that I had that makes me be able to sit here today with you.
Now you're running as a Republican,
yes,
and the Republican Party is going through like a transformation, or there's a lot of infighting and stuff, particularly at the top. On the national level, where do you stand with the Trump administration? What's going on? Are you a never Trump? Are you supporting of what he's doing? How do you assess the state of the Republican Party as a Republican?
Right? Sure. Look, I'm a conservative, and I think it's important for us to be united as Republicans. I do support our current administration, Mr. Trump, and I think he's got a lot of great ideas. I think the people spoke, and the primary, you know, a lot of people were not on board, but once he became the nominee, I think what we saw was a lot of Republicans did come together to support Mr. Trump because there is so much at stake, right? I mean, especially where we're looking at now with the Gorsuch Supreme Court fight. I mean, that's a pretty critical function that the Office of the Presidency has to appoint Supreme Court justices.
This is The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes, chatting with Bernie Jacques, a candidate for House District 66.
I'll transition to another more immediate Florida-based issue, and that is a state attorney.
Right.
Aramis Ayala out of Orlando, which the county's there, and her decision to not prosecute the death penalty and go forward there. What do you say to her stance and the reaction from lawmakers here in Tallahassee and the governor to restrict her ability to even do her job as is right now?
Right. I think her stance is dead wrong, both from a policy perspective, I'm a believer in the death penalty, but also from a rule of law perspective. Again, we're talking about Judge Gorsuch, about how, as a judge, his role is to follow the law. Similarly, our state attorneys take an oath to execute the laws. And the laws are in the books and placed there by our legislature. And our legislature have said that there is death penalty. There is a death penalty in the books. So for a state attorney to just say outright that she will not seek it for any case is a dereliction of her duty. It's a deviation from what she swore to uphold. It'd be one thing if she did a case-by-case analysis and used her discretion in that fashion to say, well, I don't think the death penalty merits this particular case, as all state attorneys have that discretion. But to do a blanket statement and say, I will not follow a particular portion of the law, I think is a betrayal to her commitment and fidelity to the Florida Constitution, which she swore to uphold, to follow. And as far as a reaction, I think it's appropriate because the legislative branch serves as a check. You know, we live in a co-equal branches of government. Her function is executive. The legislature is legislative, and they have the power of the purse. And that's a function of theirs that they can use to correct a decision they don't like. And it's almost as if she is, I will argue she is, she's crossing the boundaries into the legislative functions and basically nullifying laws that the legislature put on the books. Legislature said we have a death penalty, and she's unilaterally saying no in her circuit, and that's wrong. And it offends me, you know, too, as a former prosecutor, where I've seen these cases, and mind you, in our office, we didn't seek the death penalty willy-nilly. It was for the most severe circumstances, and it's really a sad thing for the victims when they know if they go up to our circuit here in Central Florida that in essence they will not be avenged if the worst of the worst happened to them, you know, as far as a murder and the like.
The death penalty isn't a squeaky clean process, and she did identify all the wrongs and the pitfalls and the inconsistencies, particularly to African-American individuals and all of that stuff, and so many other things that's wrong with the death penalty. It was even ruled unconstitutional. So where's the effort to fix the process of the death penalty, unlike what she was arguing, waiting until it's fixed, at least throwing the check back to the legislature to say at least fix it, and then I'll continue on.
Right.
I don't know if that's exactly what she's pushing for, but it seems like it would be logical. Why don't you fix it, and then we'll go forward and reinstate this process.
Sure, and don't get me wrong, she's entitled to her view that the system is flawed or that she doesn't agree.
Do you think it's flawed?
I don't think so, especially now. And there has been a fix. The legislature went back and made it unanimous now for the jury to find somebody deserving of death. Prior to that, it was just a sheer majority. Then they went to the 10-2.
But that was just like a narrow fix as opposed to all the other issues that...
Well, look, and I'll say this to her. You know, if there's a policy she doesn't agree with, you change policies in the legislative branch. When you're an executive, you execute what's on the books. So she has a right to have her view, but I think her view has to be checked at the door when it comes at odds with her oath. So policy judgments should not equate abandoning your oath and your role as a person who will abide by the law.
That's it for this edition of The Rotunda. Be sure to join us again next week for more stories about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. I'm Tramell Gomes.